Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and you know, for the last 4 years or so, the issues of the public lands have in the American West have been on the radar and getting a lot of attention in the news, in part because the administration of Donald Trump sought to tear apart two large national monuments that had been created by Democratic presidents in Utah and increase oil and gas usage and just the general anti-environmental politics of the last 4 years. And now the way in which it seems that President Biden is changing this up, and we're entering into a new era where public lands are being taken seriously as a policy agenda, which at least for me is a pretty big relief. And to think about public lands a little bit and talk about this for the next half an hour or so, I invited on to today one of the real historians who's a true expert on the public lands, somebody who has lived in the public lands, who has worked on the public lands, and has written on the public lands at a tremendous length. And that is Adam Sowers, who is a professor at the university in the history department at the University of Idaho. Just to give you a couple of his publications, in last year, he published An Open Pit Visible from the Moon, The Wilderness Act, and the Fight to Protect Miners Ridge in the Public Interest. That came out from the University of Oklahoma Press. In 2009, he published an environmental biography of William O. Douglas, the famous Supreme Court justice, entitled The Environmental Justice, William O. Douglas and American Conservation. And it was published by Oregon State University Press. Adam, thank you for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Eric. Thanks.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, as somebody who lives in Idaho, you know, in a liberal town in a pretty conservative state, you know, and has written extensively, I should have said that as well, has written extensively on this, these issues for High Country News, which is a really great journal of the American West. You know, just going to start with a broad question. What has the last 4 years been like for you as an advocate for the public lands living in the Trump administration?
Oh, what a great question. I guess the simplest answer is it's been rough. One of the things that you see for the last several decades, actually not just the last 4 years, is that so many policies can be reversed so quickly. In many ways, Congress gridlocks in the 1990s, stops passing major environmental legislation. And so every new administration can roll back administrative rules or play with the budgeting process. And so any gain feels like it's only as good as long as the president remains in that particular party. So watching Donald Trump roll back various regulations or rules that implement those regulations was difficult. One of the things that was most difficult, I think, to watch was the diminishment of Bears Ears National Monument. Bears Ears was really interesting as a tribal-led initiative. The Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, which began with five different indigenous nations asking for a solution, Congress not coming up with one, and Barack Obama finally creating smaller than the coalition had asked for, but still a substantial national monument. And then when President Trump came in, he appointed Ryan Zinke to go and look at this, and it was diminished by something like 85%. And then Grand Staircase Escalante was cut in about half. And so that's really tough to see those gains and that protection rolled back. President Biden has signaled that he will restore those cuts. And today, as you know, Deb Haaland was voted out of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and looks to be headed for confirmation for Secretary of Interior. And she would be the one that would be overseeing the restoration of those lands. So that's some of my reaction to the last 4 years.
Yeah, I want to talk about Haaland in a minute, but I wanted to think a little bit more about Trump and the rollback of the national monuments, because, you know, when he appoints Zinke and Zinke goes out and, you know, plays cowboy in the West and gets his picture taken at all those national monuments and then, you know, reduces Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, I thought, well, you know, is this going to be a, you know, just a slaughter, you know, where, you know, as an Oregonian, the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument has been controversial down near the California border, and it looked like that might be the next one. And, you know, of course, President Obama had created so many national monuments in Nevada as part of Harry Reid's legacy. And yet it didn't really go any further than the Utah monuments. And I'm wondering, did that surprise you, or why do you think that they actually stopped at Utah?
I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to go back and look at the timeline. I know Ryan Zinke got in trouble and didn't stick around as Secretary of Interior very long because of some ethical questions. And that could be part of it. Part of it, too, I think, is our previous president has a notoriously short attention span. So perhaps there was just not the ability to withstand that going forward. And then one of the key drivers, I think, in all of this was Rob Bishop, who was the representative out of Utah, who was so opposed to Bears Ears and unable to deliver a deal, which Barack Obama had asked Congress to do this so that he wouldn't have to declare a national monument. I guess it's always tempting to say that we expected more bad things coming from the Trump administration on public lands. But I don't have a super clear answer on that question. I think it's complicated. I think that in places like Nevada and Oregon, where you mentioned, the politics are not the same as in Utah. So that may have made it a more controversial perspective. Although I guess I'd point out that it's public lands are really, really popular. And this is something that, I mean, I think that elected Republican officials are real far outliers in their opposition to public lands. If you look at, for example, the State of the Rockies report, which is an annual survey that comes out of Colorado College, you see overwhelming numbers of Westerners count themselves as conservationists, count themselves as really strong believers in the public land system. And so these efforts to undermine them frequently end up coming undone in face of that public opposition.
Yeah, I mean, one of the kind of ironies of Zinke, right, is that, you know, he was talking, you know, about slashing all these monuments in Utah, but then he had his own vision for protecting lands in Montana and seems to, you know, whatever possible political career he may or may not have, he maybe doesn't have one much anymore, but when it was clear that was his aim was to eventually maybe be governor of Montana, you know, he was talking about preserving more public lands in Montana. And, you know, I guess thinking about a state, you know, Utah may be an outlier for a number of reasons, but thinking about states like Idaho or Montana that are fundamentally pretty conservative. And yet, you know, I guess my question for you is how are these debates taking place at the state level in states like Idaho and Montana, where you do have significant amounts of public lands and protection and yet and conservative politics, and yet, you know, not the same kind of federal effort to undermine them?
Yeah, I suppose every state's got a slightly different experience and different political texture to it. And it strikes me that I think in Montana and Idaho, to use the states you mentioned, oil and gas is not as strong as it is in Utah, which I think probably also played a role into those sorts of things. My sense is locally here, Idaho, access is very important. And that means different things to different people. And for example, it might mean access if you are a snowmobiler and want access to the public lands to do that, which would prevent you from supporting certain types of public land protections like wilderness and resist that. On the other hand, we have a really large Texas-based family that has acquired a significant amount of private land, and they have the ability, because of where it's positioned, to block people's access to public lands, and that created a huge backlash in Idaho. I think that the public enjoys access to the public lands in a variety of different ways. And so to speak about it all in big, broad terms as though it's the same thing is probably a mistake always. But to recognize the many different ways, whether it's hunting or fishing, or whether it's backpacking, whether it's snowmobiling or mountain biking, I think the public lands allow for all of those things, although not all of those things in the same place at the same time, as well as to use them for extraction. These are places that resources are taken from through mining or logging, although a lot less of that than there used to be, or grazing animals. And I think that those economic priorities in places like Idaho and Montana are going to look different from southern Utah by the nature of the resources and the populations that are nearby and want that access.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that that's, you know, the complexity of what you're describing is interesting in thinking about, you know, environmental politics in the West generally, right? Because you know, it's easy to say, for instance, that you know, as people do, as I teach, that, you know, in the big environmental legislation of the late 60s and early 70s was passed by, you know, almost unanimous consent in Congress, and that there was this sort of overarching, you know, desire to protect the environment in a way that was bipartisan then, that's very much not now. But, you know, at the same time, of course, at the local level in you know, in Oregon, let's say, which of course I know well, or really all of the West, you know, there, it wasn't uncontroversial, right, that there were major battles on the ground about, you know, early wilderness protection, what to protect and what not to, and all of that. And so, you know, I guess that's a kind of way of getting at a question about environmental politics at the state level, which is that, you know, is there, these states are so, like the rest of the country, so polarized in many, many ways, that you have a California utterly now dominated by Democrats and an Idaho dominated by Republicans. Is there, you know, common ground to be had over the public lands in terms of building political coalitions?
That's my great hope, although I'm not always hopeful about it. I do believe that that's a possibility. And I go back to that State of the Rockies survey that I mentioned a few minutes ago that shows this overwhelming public support for public lands that does draw across partisan boundaries. One of the challenges for environmental politics in the West, as I know that you understand, is it's now just one more prong in the culture war that is national and even international at this point. So that becomes harder and harder, where your position on perhaps a public land bill is perhaps more connected to your position on the Second Amendment than anything to have to do with a particular stream being considered or national forest and management plan like that. So that becomes harder. But I do think you can find in certain places where these communities can come together around some common issues. Often this requires having some external enemy. A fear of Californians works really well in the American West, often to bring together coalitions of local people to try to keep Californians out, or to keep the desire to keep open space is a way to bring sometimes unlikely allies together to prevent, say, subdivisions, mini ranchette developments in the sort of borderland between public and private lands. So I think that those are possibilities for hope. And I think back to, you know, the Bundy takeover, the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. And it was a spectacular event, lots of media attention and all that sort of thing. But locals ultimately reject it. And a large reason that they ultimately rejected it is because they had spent decades trying to get beyond that sort of politics, that sort of polarization where there's just arguing all the time. And that's not easy. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of listening to build those sorts of coalitions, but it happens. And when that does happen, you can withstand some of the national story and noise that's going on all around these sorts of issues.
To take this a little more local for you, I mean, thinking about these issues in Idaho, you know, is there a state of environmental politics in Idaho at this point? I mean, you know, Idaho seems to be a state that's changing to some extent because of the pretty heavy growth of Boise, but obviously electorally it's extraordinarily conservative. Can we identify, say, in a obviously Republican-dominated state legislature, is there an environmental ethos other than just appeasing extractive industry that we who support public lands can kind of hold on to as maybe a base to build off of?
Possibly. It's tricky. It's really tricky. And I would point to a member of Congress, Mike Simpson of Idaho, who has worked hard to protect some wilderness. Now, many wilderness activists would have liked more protected or with fewer compromises put in. He just recently, though, put out, we need to study removing the four dams on the lower Snake River, which is not a public lands issue, but it's related to environmental politics. And it's a super hot issue in the Pacific Northwest. So here's this Republican from a very conservative state announcing this, and immediately, the Republican representatives from Eastern Washington said there's no way that's going anywhere. So there are people like Mike Simpson out there who is not going to always have as strong a position on, say, endangered species as I might like, or on other environmental matters. But then occasionally he will have that notion. I mean, I think he really believes that salmon should come back and be in these streams. And I think that he really believes there are certain landscapes in Idaho that ought to be protected. So I think that is the case, that there are people like that you could build deliberately and carefully some common ground around. I know that there's been efforts in the past, hasn't borne fruit yet to protect some wilderness up in the Selkirks in northern Idaho as well, which would require some collaboration with Montana politicians. But I think that that's possible. And I think it's possible because so many of their constituents love these places, love hiking there with their families, love fishing and hunting there. And the more development in certain of these public lands, the harder those things are going to be to do.
Yeah, I mean, since you know it's not public lands, but since we are kind of going that way anyway a bit, thinking a little bit about salmon, and you know, one thing, since Simpson did have that proposal to potentially get rid of those four dams that have been on the environmental agenda to do that for a very, very long time, is the way in which salmon seems to be both a regional identity in the Pacific Northwest, but also tied up into the culture wars. And that, you know, you have a lot of people, say, in Eastern Washington or parts of Idaho that are a lot more invested in Lewiston having a port, an ocean port 500 miles inland than they are about saving salmon. And, I was wondering if your sense of the salmon issues was similar to mine, like has it become a kind of proxy for the larger culture war in the Northwest?
Yeah, I think in some ways it really does. And when these conversations come up, there immediately are accusations hurled at Seattle and all the bad things that Seattle does, which is sort of neither here nor there, or discussion of orcas being the real culprit in terms of eating salmon and that sort of thing. So it's really, to use a very tired phrase, but the sort of coastal elites get blamed for these things. And whenever you use tired phrases like that, I think you're falling into that trap of talking about these broader cultural issues without the specificity that I think is necessary to really look squarely in the eye these dams or whatever the issue might be, to look at economic, environmental, and political in terms of like how democracy is supposed to work of these sorts of issues.
Yeah. So I guess to switch gears here a bit, since we promised it earlier in this podcast, I think that the President Biden nominating Deb Haaland to be Secretary of Interior is pretty remarkable. Of course, Haaland is Laguna. She is a environmental activist. The Department of Interior has authority over Native American issues, and it's been an agency of abuse for a very, very long time. And it seems to me, anyway, that this is a remarkable shift in American politics to have Howland, to just have a Native woman be Secretary of Interior. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about this this nomination that is probably going to be confirmed.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. I mean, this is such a remarkable historic event for her to be nominated, and looks like she's not going to have trouble being confirmed. And I mean, just to have, I mean, you said it well, to have a Native woman in the cabinet itself is really remarkable. Authority in Interior goes over the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but also in terms of land, the Bureau of Land Management and National Parks. And there's a fraught, long history around Indigenous lands and public lands, and to have someone that is quite sensitive to that history, understanding it, and wanting to really put, I think, questions of environmental justice and climate justice and have that really be guiding the department is such a remarkable change from having an oil and gas lobbyist in charge, which is what we just got past. So this is a remarkable, great, I hope, a great day for the public lands and for Native people throughout the nation. And I find her story quite inspiring, frankly, more than most cabinet picks.
Yes, for sure. I mean, what do we think that... So I guess if there was one knock on Howland is that she doesn't have, at least to my knowledge, you know, the same kind of administrative experience over large agencies that, say, Marty Walsh will bring to labor, let's say, or others. You know, and that may not matter. But I guess what I am wondering is what do you think, in a concrete fashion, having somebody like Howland at Interior, like what can that achieve?
Yeah. So like I said earlier in this conversation, with Congress not making lots of changes in environmental policy, lots of changes get written and the administration of those laws. And so in that respect, cabinet secretaries can ask for new rules to be made. This happens every administration. So she can oversee those sorts of things, change how the Endangered Species Act might be implemented or National Environmental Policy Act might be implemented. I suspect, based on what I'm seeing, that relocation of the Bureau of Land Management to Grand Junction, Colorado, that could be re-examined to put the head of the BLM back in Washington, D.C., closer to other administrative units that it's important to cooperate with. So, I mean, a cabinet secretary cannot do everything. It cannot pass laws in Congress, but from identifying budget priorities to identifying rules that can be adapted and changed, I think that that's a lot. And there's also just sort of the symbolic effort to move. One of the Biden administration's big goals is they call it the 30 for 30. They're trying to get 30% of the land protected in some form or another by 2030. So having an Indigenous person ahead of that, I think, is really useful, and someone that's involved with Green New Deal sort of legislation and trying to stop make as many dollars out of the public lands as they can, which is not the mission of the public land system.
Yeah, I mean, so what do you think? What do you think for those people who, you know, are good liberals or progressives or whoever you want to describe yourself, but maybe don't know too much about the public lands or haven't spent a lot of time on them? Should be key priorities for everyday people to make demands of our government on in terms of public lands? In other words, like, what is the Adam Sowards public lands political agenda that we should be following?
Wow. I've never thought of it quite like that. Well, you know what? I'm going to start with a quotation that I really like from Terry Tempest Williams, who says, "The integrity of our public lands depends on the integrity of our public process within the open space of democracy." And I really love that sense of integrity, and that public lands depend on a public process. So from that perspective, I would want to see NEPA and the environmental impact statement process work well, to have access to the public, to be able to share their views. I would love to see a Congress that's a little more responsive to actually what voters want in terms of public lands, rather than what lobbyists want or what the culture warriors want in this particular perspective. The Land and Water Conservation Fund is one of my favorite pieces of legislation. There's an enormous amount of money available in there to purchase land and to improve the management of public lands. And it has been protected, but if the monies in that fund need to be distributed, so then Congress has to get on that. And I think that that's something that's really important. As we deal with a world that is undergoing climate change and the sixth extinction that we're facing, I think protecting species and using these lands to try to deal with the climate crisis and the climate justice crisis that's coming our way, these are all really key. Maybe they're a little more idealistic than practical politics, but I think that that sense of integrity about both the ecological space that the public lands represent and the political space that they represent, I would love to just see more integrity in that process.
Yeah, I think we want to wrap up with this, but to kind of think about one issue that we haven't talked about yet, since you brought up climate change, is the issue of fire, right? That you know, we've seen in the last, really since 2000, vastly increased large fires. Devastating to me is a lot of the areas in Western Oregon that really just don't traditionally burn at this level burned last year. 2 years in the last, I think four, there have been major smoke events in the Willamette Valley that never happened when I was growing up. And so that's a really measurable difference. And it feels like Southern Oregon burns pretty much every year at this point. And you know, fire is a part of the ecology of the West. And, you know, you have a century of the Forest Service and the BLM suppressing fire. And I guess, you know, what do we do here? Like it's such a difficult and tricky situation. There's no good answers. The climate continues to change. But in terms of concrete issues that really affect Westerners, it's other than perhaps water supplies, there's not too much that's more important than fire. And so could you address the fire situation, and is there a way forward to at least manage these fires in a more effective fashion than we've seen lately?
Wow, that's a really big question, Eric. Fire is huge, and it can be damaging, and solving the problem is not going to be easy, partly because solving the problem is going to require a whole lot of money. And I think there are going to be places that are just going to burn, and that's something that we have to accept, in part because some places have always burned. I think we can treat the land in a variety of ways so that those burns become less damaging, both ecologically and economically, for people that live on these fire lines. But prescribed burns are expensive. They tend to be pretty small. And Congress doesn't seem to have a lot of money to put forward for this sort of thing. This would be a possibility with great funding to have more prescribed burns, more partnerships with state agencies, partnerships with tribal communities where there's indigenous knowledge about burning these lands. It strikes me that it's a place where lots more people could be involved to try to make the situation less damaging and less hurtful. These communities that are overrun, it's an incredibly sad situation. Being stuck indoors in the summer because the smoke is so bad is an inconvenience, but it represents really bad things. I don't think the solution, though, I know that a common solution is more logging. That's not always the answer, because we see the evidence shows that where there's more logging, there's more fire. So clear cuts don't burn real well, but neither do parking lots. That's not what we want either. We don't want to turn all these things into parking lots. So, I mean, it takes investment and a commitment, and I'm not sure that we've seen lots of evidence of that. It's not a high priority to treat such a difficult, knotty problem that covers so many millions of acres. And now is, of course, is exacerbated by global climate change.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think it in some ways sums up the kind of history of public lands in a sense, in that, you know, there's has been periodic political attention to the public lands for sure. But at the same time, so often they've been left to neglect or left to corporate domination. And so we just face a century of or more of mistakes that have been made. But, you know, it's tough. I mean, I wish I had an answer too. But, you know, to kind of, I guess, to close out here, you know, tell us one thing that is a takeaway for our listeners that is something real positive about the public lands. I mean, for instance, I know you do a lot of teaching in the public lands. You know, can you sort of describe, I guess, to end this positive, like what is it like to take a group of students out into these amazing places that you luckily have access to living in Idaho?
Yeah, so thanks for mentioning that. I teach in the Semester in the Wild program at the University of Idaho in the heart of the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness area. And it's like I'm almost speechless trying to think about it. It's the most amazing place I think I've ever been. And to work with young people in their 20s, to talk about public lands issues right smack dab in the middle of these places, to talk about the history of the indigenous people who lived there, the miners or ranchers who lived nearby. It's really an incredible place. The public lands are the public's. They're open, they're available. Pretty much every, the top most beautiful places that I've ever experienced almost are always in these public lands in one, whether it's a national forest or a national park or a wildlife refuge. It's an amazing place to be, to spend time in, to think about, to be inspired by, to see the stars. I mean, when I'm out there with those students, I mean, the closest road is some 30 miles away, so there's not a lot of ambient light ruining the view. So it's a really remarkable place with clean air, and it's a really inspiring experience. And students come away from those experiences really changed as people. And I mean, the dirty little secret is I come away changed as a person too. I mean, it's been a remarkable experience for me.
Yeah, I've seen a few pictures over the years, and it just totally blows my mind. I can't tell you how jealous I am. I mean, I like being in Rhode Island, but the one big disadvantage is we don't have a lot of public lands, and certainly not like they do in Idaho or Oregon or New Mexico, where I lived for a long time. So, yeah, it sounds amazing. So anyway, well, thank you again, Adam. Just as a reminder to our listeners, we've been talking to Adam Sowards at the University of Idaho. And Adam, thank you so much again for joining us today.
It is my pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
We'll see everybody soon. Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,